Accession number 30403, Mr. Andre Codin, Reel 11. Now, any other stories you've got from your time? You were in Dusseldorf, what, from 48 to 52? Four years, you said. Yeah. Any other things or other stories that came out?
No. Nothing very eventful. We were billeted in Dusseldorf in the central, what was it called? Landeskriminalpolizeiamt, which means the land criminal police headquarters, right? And of the German, the German criminal police. And we used their fingerprint blokes, if we, theft, etc. So, used as fingerprints. Also, when I returned with smelly knickers after an alleged rape investigation, we used them, and either they sent it up, or sometimes I used an excuse to get up to Hamburg, because they had to be sent to the German police laboratories in Hamburg. To break the monotony of my existence in Düsseldorf, I took a trip up to Hamburg with the filthy knickers and spent 48 hours there till they gave me the report, and I returned with the knickers. And we got on all right with them, although there were some incidences also. For example, we used their photographers, right? Now, when there was a case of rape, we always took a photographer with us to take a photo of the scene, because they usually occurred not in houses, but in parks, in the woods, right, or on the riverbank, or so. And there was, I remember one incident when I overheard. We had taken the photographer, the girl, right, and me in front, and I had a driver and a jeep, and we were just returning from the place where the incident was supposed to have occurred, and I heard the photographer talking to the girl there behind me. And I pitied the girl because it was a gang rape. By the way, the the Welsh Fusiliers were very, 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 very much involved in that sort of thing. And I heard him talk to the girl at the back. I felt really pity for her, and she had a real case. It wasn't an invented thing or elaborated or embellished. On the contrary, I had to use a great deal of persuasion for her to go into details and render the whole story, because she felt embarrassed, etc., and hurt. And I heard him say to her, well, what do you expect from them? They're occupiers, etc. He was letting off in that vein. And I turned round to him, because I knew of him. He was a photographer with the German army, the occupation in the East, Poland and in Russia, right? And I turned round to him and I said, I forgot his first name, I called him always for his first name. I said, tell me, how many investigations did you go out on rapes by German soldiers of Polish or Jewish or Russian women? Did you take many photos on that? I said, no. You took photos of the woods, etc., where you suspected so-called partisans and whatnot. Did you ever investigate an alleged rape by a German soldier? So before you shoot your mouth off, I gave him a real dressing there. I said, think a little bit and be honest with yourself.
Now, any other instance?
No, nothing.
Now, how did your time come to an end there? You were there till 52, weren't you? Well,
yeah.
Why did you finish then?
I had enough. I had merit in the meantime.
Now, when did you get married? Where did you meet your wife?
Oh, I met my wife in Berlin. She was a member of the Greek military mission accredited to the Allied powers in Berlin. And mine was an army marriage, and when I left Berlin, she came over to...
So what year had you got married?
Hmm?
What year had you been married in?
1951, I can't remember. There's my wife. Here.
And so you... Well, so you married her after you'd gone to Dusseldorf? So what made you decide? So you were going to leave. What were you going to do? And how did you go about leaving? You know, I mean.
Well, I just didn't renew my engagement. I was on a regular engagement, which.
You were a regular soldier.
Yeah, which matured in May 52, and I didn't renew it. They tried to talk me into taking a short service engagement. And I didn't. I said, where the hell am I going to end up? I've got to go into Civis Street sometime. And I, in the meantime, had got information that my mother had survived. And she had been taken to Israel, and I couldn't do much in the army, and I said, well, time has come to call it a day.
So where were you demobilized from?
Pardon?
Where were you demobilized from?
Well, I was sent over here, where was it, getting old. Where was it?
It's all right. What do you remember about the demobilisation?
Well, nothing. I just spent a day there, then got my civis.
What do you think of your suit?
Oh, well, it was nice.
And what were you going to do? You know, you've come out of the army. Were you going to get?
I had no people in this country. I had a friend in Oxford, and he had married a Welsh girl, and he had a house, and he said he was going to put me up when I first, because I had no place to go to and not many savings. I think I had about 500 quid, which at the time was a lot of money, but meaningless otherwise. And so I went to Oxford, and then I was sent on a course to High Wycombe, a government training centre.
Now, what were you studying there?
Telecommunication, and I became a telecommunication engineer. And I got a job in near Oxford. There was a GPO radio station there. They were transmitting all the the Reuters and news agency stuff, and also for the Americans, all their transmissions back home via Iceland.
Now that's a good job. That was a good job then.
Well,
did you enjoy it?
I would have stayed in it, but it was impossible. My wife had to stay back in Oxford. There was a bus. Once a week, I could see her. There was a bus which I took on Saturday, and went to Oxford and came back again. And I couldn't find the only place I found there near the station was on a farm. We had a driver on the station, and his parents had a farm, and they let me a room, right? And they were very nice people, very kind and well-meaning, but the farmer's wife had a habit of giving me breakfast, always scrambled eggs. And however often I remonstrated, she insisted on me having scrambled eggs on toast. But every time I had to leave the room and put a mouthful of eggshells that she always managed to get into the scrambled eggs into my handkerchief.
So how long, what did you do next?
I couldn't, impossible to find accommodation. I thought I found accommodation once, because I came across an advertisement and somebody told me about it. There were two sisters who were also farmers, and or the farmers' daughters, and the father had died, and the mother was alone on the farm, and they were looking for someone. They were going to let half the accommodation, right? But to people prepared to look after their mother. And I said, well, that's okay. My wife could speak a great deal of English then. And so I went down to see him. He saw the place, and the farmer's wife, she was quite pleased to see us, spoke to her. But then the daughters said no. Why? Because my wife was a foreigner. Now, you must remember that at that time in Oxford, when I went round looking for ulterior accommodation, there were notices in the windows, right? Because they were foreign students and whatnot. There were notices in the windows saying, no foreigners. So it was a hopeless situation. And by chance, a chap I knew who had been one of Colonel Buckmaster's men. Do you know who he is? Colonel Buckmaster?
From the Special Operations Executive.
Yeah. And he had been one of his blokes. He was dropped in France. But as usual, the so-called resistance, it wasn't the resistance who waited for him, it was the Gestapo who had waited for him. He was given away, and he was taken to Paris, to Fresnes prison. He was supposed to be, he was interrogated, knocked about, etc. And then they were going to execute him. But the German counterintelligence, the army counterintelligence, who were not very friendly with the Gestapo, you know, they were not the best of pals, they asked for him under some subterfuge or real reason. They want to interrogate him. And then, either intentionally or by mistake, instead of returning him to the Gestapo, he was sent to Colditz Castle. And he spent the rest of the war in Colditz Castle. Now, he heard through a friend of mine that I was a bit of a fix for a job, and by that time, he had become the managing director of a UK branch of a very large Australian company. And he got in touch with me and he said, look, the managing director is all coming over from Australia, and I've been pushing for having an assistant. And he'll want to see you. And I'll get you an interview. And well, before he came, he wrote to me, and I left the station for a couple of days. I went to London, and I stayed in the Victory Club, the Mad Lodge, and I went and had the interview, which was in Mayfair, with the managing director. And he was all right, but my friend had warned me, don't tell him that you spent 12 years in the army, because that won't impress him, right? So I didn't mention it. And so when he asked me, what did you do before, you know? So I told one of the biggest lies in my life. It wasn't a lie. I said, I worked for the BBC. And he was so terribly impressed by that, he didn't ask any further. Now, what he didn't know was that before I joined the army, I worked for the Birmingham Bicycle Company.
So what was this job as? An assistant manager doing what?
Yeah. Well, they were a very large company. At the time, they were shipping... in Australia, they had a paper factory, a fruit packing factory, a meat factory, slaughterhouses, and they were shipping corned beef, or at that time it was corned mutton, and to England.
So they were a shipping company.
Then they bought, or they became partners, to a Greek shipping company. And when they heard that my wife was Greek, they made me a director of that shipping company, which they bought together with a Greek shipping company. And they were shipping, our ships carried, you remember the, what were they called? Subaru cars, yeah? What were they called? Subaru, I think they were called Subaru. You know, it's amazing that my memory goes. Anyhow, they had a contract with the Far Eastern makers of that car.
So that settles you into civilian employment, and then you moved to London.
Yeah, I stayed with them for 35 years.
And you were based in London?
What?
You lived in London?
Yeah, then I moved to London.
Now, the only other thing is, did you ever get tempted to go back to Austria? Did you make visits to Austria? Just tell us, because I know you did, you know, eventually. But did you ever think of going back to Austria?
No, never. After I had been to Austria in 1945, when I was stationed in Berlin, my commanding officer, a very understanding chap, he sent me there on a duty trip. And he gave me a fortnight and booked me into a good hotel that was used by the RAF personnel who were flying to Vienna and back. And my experience there, and what I found out what happened to all my friends and people I knew, and the attitude of the Austrians themselves, especially the Viennese, I didn't even stay there a fortnight but I left before, and I swore never to put my foot in the place again.
You just didn't like the place, and what it, you didn't like the place and how they behaved and what it stood for.
Well, it I found what happened. Well, I showed you, for example, this report on that girl. Yeah, remember?
They don't remember. Now, can you just explain to what you're on about?
Well, it's the fate of my, obviously, my Jewish friends and non-Jewish friends who were not Nazis. There was not a single survivor of that young socialist youth section that I belonged to. Not a single one of them survived. Right? And let me tell you, I went back to the, I was an apprentice in a mechanical workshop. I went back there and to see what happened to them. And there was not a single Jew among them. I was the only Jew in the place at the time. And I walked in there and they looked, you know, someone in the workshop was in the Russian sector, and they saw a British uniform there, and they looked, sir, in astonishment. And I took my hat off, and then one of them recognized me from the back of the shop. They shouted, "Oh, Jesus Christ, it's Andy, the apprentice lad. He's still alive." And they said that in a chorus, you know, "He's still alive," in astonishment. And my experience there, because they didn't ask a single word of what I had happened to me, etc., etc. And the owner of the firm was a Jewish man. And he had been a very kind man that even shook my attitude to so-called capitalists. And I regarded him as a capitalist. And he treated one of the blokes, who was a handyman, whom even I, as a apprentice, used to give orders to, and very kindly. And I asked this bloke, "Well, what happened to the boss?" And all he could say was, "Oh, they came and took him away." Right? And he had a special reason to be very grateful to the boss's wife, because she was very kind to him. And then I said, "Well, what happened to his wife?" "Oh, well, they took her away and all." And that's all he could say. Now, these two people had treated him when he was in a very tight situation very kindly. Now, the boss had given him a backdated 6 month backdated rise, substantial rise, when he heard that his wife was pregnant 6 months, and he was in danger of losing his place, his flat. And he had given him a substantial rise, backdated 6 months. And the wife, when she was, she insisted to be told when his wife got her baby, to be told if it was a girl or a boy. And when that happened, she two girls, two typists from the office came over with two large cartons from a shop in Vienna that was the equivalent of Harrods in London, full of two sets of baby outfits with everything you can think of, you know. So you would have thought that he would have had a kind word to say in memory of these people, but all he could say is, "Whoa, they came and took him away."
Now, these former employers, they were Jewish, weren't they?
What?
The employers, the capitalists, they were Jewish.
Yes, they were Jewish people.
And that's presumably why they didn't care much.
Why what?
Well, that's why the workers didn't care much. That's the point you're making.
No, they were not. They were not politically at all. They were not socialists or whatever. The fact is that
they just didn't care.
They just didn't care. They were Jewish people. That happened to the Jews. Finished.
Now, so you decided never to go back?
I swore I'd never go back there again. But I did break my word in the year 2000, because a friend of mine who married an Austrian girl who came over here as an au pair girl to learn English and whatnot, he married her, and he always, every year, went to Austria with his wife. He drove there in his car and then toured all over the place. And he badgered me year after year, until in the year 2000, I agreed. And we went there, and I had two feelings, two emotions. On the one hand, I reproached myself for having broken my word, but what I experienced there on my visit again convinced me that my undertaking never to go there again was justified.
So what did you see on this second visit? Things hadn't changed then?
No. Not the Austrians. Not the Viennese.
There was still anti-Semitic or non-political?
Oh, yes, basically the common blokers. Gave not a thought. Mind you, there are other people there, but they're a tiny minority. I got in touch with one section of them, and I'm in touch with them still. I get a lot of literature from them, etc., etc. But they are a tiny minority. And I respect them the more because of it, because they find themselves in a tiny minority.
Thank you very much.